Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, January 14th, 2016. This podcast is dedicated to the memory of Al Hart. I'll pay tribute to my friend Al Hart at the end of this podcast. He was a legendary Bay Area broadcaster and news anchor. Sly Stone opens our podcast today with Somebody's Watching You, and we have an interesting investigative piece from Vice News exposing how the Stingray and Dirtbox technology that's been used in the United States is now being employed in Britain and across the globe. Mass surveillance using people's cell phones has become the new normal. And while laws vary from nation to nation, and I believe that our Constitution bans this kind of mass surveillance of innocent people in an attempt to track the signals or the location of a suspect, in Britain, the laws are different. And it appears there are no restrictions on the use by law enforcement of these systems that are called IMSI. And I don't even know what IMSI stands for. They are also known as Stingrays or cell site simulators. I'm sure those letters include simulator in there somewhere. So the IMSI category uses our cell phones, particularly smartphones that cough up a location, not just your phone number, but the serial number of the phone and the number of your account with your telephone carrier. We know that more sophisticated versions of Stingray and Dirtbox can access your voicemail, can access your email, your contacts, and cough them up. And we've been sounding the alarm here for over 2 years. After the FBI in this country started to share Stingray-type technology with local law enforcement agencies, but with non-disclosure agreements. It's all supposed to be secret. And this is the kind of creeping police state and the tactics of a police state that I strenuously object to. So I'm linking in the show file for this podcast to the video report that Vice News put together, and I encourage you to watch it because it shows that they went around with a cell phone, I don't know exactly. It's an analytic device of some sort. And a guy with a laptop, for example, went outside the Ecuadorian embassy in London where Julian Assange is holed up and was able to detect the spurious signals from an IMSI device. And we know that these devices have been used in crowd control. That's the nice way of putting the mass monitoring of individuals exercising their rights to appear in public and voice their protest on any subject. So I find this fascinating, and I encourage you to watch the video. There is a companion print article about 12 pages long at the Vice News website today. And the interesting angle is that the reporter went to an event in Paris called Millipol. And Millipol is a trade show for these kinds of spy gadgets and other accessories for law enforcement. And the so-called lawful interception industry, that's what Stingray is, Harris Corporation is the biggest purveyor here in the United States, is estimated to reach sales of $1.3 billion in the next couple of years. So this is a major and growing market. Yes, surveillance is a profit center for these companies that service governments and law enforcement agencies. Now, there are many issues here. For example, what happens when Saudi Arabia uses a Stingray and finds a blogger and then, you know, either sentences him to death or public floggings for blogging? That's just one example of how these systems can be abused. And we're always just told to sit back and trust that our government's doing the right thing, and if you have nothing to hide, then you've got nothing to worry about. Now, Vice News talked to one of the vendors at this Millipol conference and tried to buy a version of Stingray called the Pocket Catcher for about $38,000 US. And the guy said he was willing to sell it to them, even though they made it clear that they were not a government agency. And so the sale, distribution, and proliferation of these devices can fall into the hands of criminal gangs and networks and groups. Think El Chapo with a stingray, right? So I believe that it's really important. And we have some listeners in Britain and in Europe, and I want you to know that this is a scourge of the modern age. And at some point, I may just put down my smartphone and sign off of Facebook in order to separate myself from this surveillance culture. That seems extreme, and I'm not prepared to do it yet. But when you see the dimensions of what governments colluding with tech corporations are able to do in violating our privacy and making our constitutional rights, particularly the Fourth Amendment, optional, well, I cannot be silent. Now, I'm amused that in Canada, they apparently aren't using stingrays or dirt boxes or IMSI devices, but they're trying to achieve a similar result, and the phone companies are fighting back, and there's a judge in Ontario who is taking their side. He is Justice John Sproat, and today he ruled that the phone companies do have an issue and that the bulk collection of cell phone records is unconstitutional in Canada. Now, the issue came up because in Ontario, police brought them warrants to turn over information on as many as 43,000 customers who fell into a kind of category, all right, that on a certain day when there was a huge jewelry store, string of robberies at jewelry stores, that their cell phones were in an area where they could have been involved. But to surveil 43,000 people to find, what, one, two, even half a dozen criminals? Well, that seems patently unconstitutional under American standards, and it does appear to be unconstitutional under Canadian standards. And so Justice Sproat said that the cell phone companies are correct, collecting information on tens of thousands of people, 99.9% of whom are innocent, is unconstitutional. Can we get a little of that south of the border? You hose heads? I'd appreciate it. Now, speaking of Canada, that's where Ted Cruz was born. And he claims that because his mother was a U.S. citizen, married to a Cuban man, that he is a natural-born American citizen. And there are law scholars who don't have any beef with Ted Cruz or any stake in whether he, you know, continues as a presidential candidate or not. But it's a serious issue. And I think it's much more substantial than the birther issues that were raised about Barack Obama. It's going to be very interesting. In South Carolina tonight, the Republican candidates are meeting for another group grope under World Wrestling Federation rules. It is a Fox Business Channel debate. And I predict that they're going to try to get Trump to attack Cruz and see how Cruz responds. And not only do we have the citizenship issue, but just yesterday, the New York Times broke a story about how Ted Cruz financed his election to the United States Senate just 4 years ago. Now, Ted Cruz was making $1 million or more a year as a lawyer. His wife works for Goldman Sachs in the wealth management department, managing the wealth of people who have $40 million or more. And Ted Cruz spun the story that he and his wife, Heidi, decided to liquidate their entire net worth, everything, and put it into the campaign. And the campaign finance reports showed that personal funds totaling as much as $1.2 million in the end, after a runoff election, came from Ted and Heidi Cruz. Well, it turns out that Heidi Cruz got her boss at Goldman Sachs to loan the couple at least $500,000 on a margin loan. And that means you are using as collateral the stocks that are held in an account at Goldman Sachs. In addition, there was another loan from Citibank, and they increased to about $1 million before they were paid down, and the Goldman Sachs loan has not been completely paid off even today. Now, neither loan appears in the Ted Cruz for Senate committee reports filed with the Federal Election Commission, which is a big, big boo-boo. They claim it was inadvertent. But Ted Cruz is going to be sweating under the lights tonight because he's going to be defensive about how he financed that campaign and about his citizenship issue. And, of course, he's got a little hypocrisy mixed in there because when he ran for the Senate, he posed as a populist firebrand criticizing Wall Street bailouts and the influence of big banks in Washington. Oh, it's amazing stuff. It really is. By the way, I learned today that Donald Trump is using some dirty, you know, trick-type tactics to try to keep other Republicans off primary ballots. Now, Illinois' primary is not, I don't even know when it is, actually. I think it might be in March or early April. And it's not clear that it will be pivotal in the selection of the Republican nominee. But in order to get on the ballot for the primary in Illinois, it's complicated. You have to get signatures, a different number of signatures from each of the state's 18 congressional districts. And candidates often stumble trying to fulfill these requirements. Rick Santorum faced major problems back in 2012. So it turns out that the campaigns of John Kasich of Ohio had problems gathering signatures in Illinois, along with the campaigns of Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, and Dr. Ben Carson. Now, there's kind of this gentleman's agreement that, we won't piss on your signatures if you don't piss on ours. So, on Wednesday, the last day for candidates to file, a representative of the Trump campaign showed up 10 minutes before closing time at the Board of Elections and tried to file objections regarding the signatures of these other candidates. But, there's the fine print here. Illinois law requires that someone objecting to a candidate's nominating papers bring both the original and two duplicates. But Trump's guy only brought the original and didn't have time to make copies or borrow a Xerox machine, I guess. Anyway, he brought the original, and then they basically kicked him out. And the other campaigns had prepared responses. If there had been an objection, they were prepared to file those, but in the end didn't have to. And I will note that this is a problem that afflicts Democrats as well. Martin O'Malley, to my knowledge, has failed to meet the requirements and the deadline to get on the ballot in the very critical state of Ohio. Now, he's polling so far out of the out of contention that it may not make a difference, but it is one of those obstacles. And just before I sat down to record, I got a call from my friend Brian. We're talking about, you know, whether Trump might bolt and run as a third-party candidate. And it's these very fine print issues of getting on the ballot that are the biggest obstacle to even a billionaire who can write a check to have lawyers, file the papers and meet all the requirements. It is a dizzying array of requirements that have to be met, and it's one of the biggest set of impediments to people who threaten to run as an independent. And while we're in Illinois, as you know, the Chicago Police Department has finally agreed, under pressure from the public, to submit to a Justice Department investigation or review. And so far, the Justice Department has not included the contentious center at Holman Square on the west side of Chicago that was exposed by the British newspaper The Guardian last year. And at Holman Square, Hundreds of people have been held in ways that are outside the law. More than 7,000 people were held there without access to an attorney. There are 20 firsthand accounts of people who were unlawfully detained at the facility. Mayor Rahm Emanuel has ducked the issue as much as he can. And finally, it seems that the Cook County Board of Commissioners, who, when I lived in Chicago 40 years ago, were firmly in the pocket of the mayor, but it's described as at odds with the mayor, the Board of Commissioners. They approved a measure yesterday calling for the Department of Justice to expand the investigation to look into the allegations of civil and human rights violations at Homan Square. And I am pleased to see it, because the board's resolution cites allegations of torture, denial of counsel, off-the-books detentions, raising serious questions of human and constitutional rights violations. So there's a lot of pressure on Rahm Emanuel, and there is no impeachment or removal process that is currently available to the denizens of the great city of Chicago. And so they're kind of stuck with Rahm, unless he will resign, which seems unlikely. Every day I like to pause for a minute and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Annette McManus, Benny Alto in Oregon, Grant Gibson in Portland, and Mark Brodsky. Last time I knew, he was north of Chicago. So I thank each and every one of you for your support and for kicking in $5, $10, $20 a month to keep it all going here. And if you've never heard your name mentioned and you're not a subscriber, I'd like you to change that. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. On the upper right-hand corner, it says menu. You click on that. Next, you click on become a subscriber. That's where your options appear, $5, $10, $20, the $50 annual. We also have the new Spreaker app, where you can listen to the PBC podcast on your Android phone. We have the highly functional, with search function, by the way, PBC app for iPhones and iPads that's available at the Apple App Store. And I've got an exciting new bonus gift that I can't announce until mid-February, but it'll be coming online shortly. So I want to ask you to step up and do your best, if you're solvent, to support my work here, and I am very grateful for those who do. We've got another wave of immigrants headed for our southern border. Some are Cubans, and I'll get to that in a moment. But the bulk are people who are fleeing drug violence and political corruption in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And border agents detained 21,000 people traveling in family groups in the last 3 months of 2015, almost triple the number monitored during the same period a year ago. The number of unaccompanied children more than doubled to 17,000, compared with under 8,000 in the last 3 months of 2014. December was the fifth highest month of child detentions on record. Now, the figures reveal the sharpest rise in vulnerable women and children seeking refuge in the U.S. since 2014. And this is a real challenge for the Obama administration, which unfortunately has responded by rounding up people for deportation. Obama didn't mention that in the State of the Union message the other night. Now, to be fair, the U.S. has spent $750 million to, or has started to spend it, let me put it that way. It was approved in the budget deal at the end of last year, to try to restore law and order in the three countries by rebuilding weak institutions like the police and judiciary. But rebuilding, that can have different connotations depending on the culture and just how corrupt these countries are. And when you talk about El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, they're deeply corrupt. So the need for a more immediate deterrent, this is according to The Guardian, may have triggered recent immigration raids across the U.S. in which 121 people were detained. Now, speaking of that roundup, some of those people had asylum petitions that were in process, and it was not legal to deport those individuals. So after the raids rounded up 121 people, last Thursday, immigration agents removed dozens of El Salvadoran women and kids from a South Texas detention center and put them on a plane to be deported. And as the flight left San Antonio, they focused on one woman named Isamar Sanchez. Well, ICE agents had raided the family's home in Virginia days earlier and took the mother and her 7-year-old daughter into custody and prepared to deport them. But when they got to Laredo, Texas, for a brief layover, the mother heard her name called. Isamar! Isamar, we're taking you back where you were. Well, it turns out that Sanchez and her daughter are now being allowed to stay in the U.S. indefinitely until their asylum petition is properly heard. And this is, one of those heart-wrenching cases where real human beings are affected by these policies. And when you hear the loudnicks like Trump just talk about building a big wall and, you know, depicting immigrants as the lowest of the low, these are real people. And we often lose sight of that in the political debates where they become just, you know, little political footballs to be bandied about. Now to the Cubans. There are 8,000 Cuban migrants who have been trapped in Costa Rica for almost 3 months now. And about 180 of them hopped on a plane and were flown to Nicaragua and also to southern Mexico. And this is a double standard, as you may know, because under American law that was written by Republicans friendly to the Cuban exiles in Miami, any Cuban who sets a single foot on U.S. soil is entitled to a green card. Now, when we were in the Cold War and people were escaping repression in Cuba, you could make that argument. I never embraced this dual standard, but people did make that argument, and I understand it. But that's over. And these Cubans are coming to the United States to take advantage of their preferential status because they're afraid that the law will be changed when ultimately we lift the trade embargo on Cuba. That may not happen soon because of the Republicans who run the Congress. But this is just another layer of complexity about the migration of human beings in our hemisphere. And with 60 million people worldwide displaced, the U.S. cannot build a wall, figuratively or physically, and just say, no one else can come in, we've got ours, we got here, screw you. But that's what so many nativists believe in. 10 more men have left Guantanamo Bay. They are all Yemeni nationals who can't go back to Yemen because of a law that was passed by Republicans due to the U.S.-led war against Yemen that's been going on for years now. So this brings the count at the prison down to 93, and these 10 men were shipped to Oman, which is a neighbor of Yemen. And we'll see how all that works out, but I am glad to see the population declining, and Obama administration officials say that they plan to release all of those who have been cleared for release by July or so, and then the population will probably be down below 50, and that's when the real shit will hit the fan. I have to give credit once again to Rachel Maddow for giving national exposure to the criminal way that the people of Flint, Michigan, had their water service changed to save a few bucks. They were getting their water from the City of Detroit Water Works, which meets standards. And when Governor Rick Snyder, the Republican, planted an emergency administrator in Flint, that person switched the water to the polluted and toxic Flint River. And the lead poisoning has reached incredible levels there. And it took months for Governor Rick Snyder to stop deflecting and denying. Finally, just before Christmas, he recognized the problem, and yesterday he actually showed up in Flint, where he's called out the National Guard, the state troopers to distribute water, and to get the Federal Emergency Management Agency to come on the scene as well. Now, the good news is that Flint has switched back to the Detroit Water Works, but the deep damage has already been done. And Rick Snyder is very much to blame. Michael Moore, who is kind of the patron saint and the guardian angel of Flint, you remember his first movie, Roger and Me, was all about the General Motors plant in Flint shutting down. He has called for the arrest and prosecution of Governor Rick Snyder. Pentagon boss Ashton Carter went to Fort Campbell and the base of the 101st Airborne and articulated a new incoherent set of strategy for the war in Syria and Iraq. Carter is signaling that after the arrival of some commandos in Iraq, that we are going to see a new plan to help Iraqi and Kurdish Peshmerga forces retake Mosul in northern Iraq and assist the Syrian moderate forces. Yeah, those Syrian moderate forces. And this is just more bullshit coming from the Obama administration. And they continue to cling to the fig leaf, the dream that they can force Assad out of power, and then somehow we can manage the situation to defeat the Islamic State in a failed state, in the vacuum of a political state that is non-existent. And then what are we going to do, install some doofus? I mean, it simply makes no sense. And this is against the context of Russian support for the Assad government. And they retook a couple of key towns in Latakia that have been under rebel control for the past 3 years. On Wednesday, government troops seized the villages of Mrunya and Marj Kaka near the town of Salma. And so what we're seeing here is that the U.S. is clinging to a strategy that has failed and will continue to fail. No matter how you move those deck chairs around, the ship is sinking. I want to thank Faith Peoples, a loyal listener who emailed me a link to this story from the Electronic Intifada. And it's fascinating because, as you know, since the last brutal assault on Gaza by Israel, where some 2,000 people were killed in 2014, well, Israel, with the help of the United Nations, negotiated what's called a GRM, the Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism. And a new legal opinion coming from the University of Nottingham's Professor Nigel White declares that this whole agreement is illegal. He said, and by the way, White is one of the leading experts on United Nations law. He says the UN, by becoming party to this deal, is contributing to the maintenance of the blockade and therefore is committing as well as aiding and assisting violations of international law. Now, this GRM is essentially the mechanism which allows Gaza to try to rebuild by importing the construction materials they need. But essentially, Israel maintains a veto over anything that they want to do in Gaza. And this is what the legal scholar here is declaring to be illegal. And after the ceasefire back in 2014, a UN special coordinator negotiated this reconstruction mechanism, which was effectively dictated by Israel according to its security requirements, and then given a stamp of approval by the UN and by the Palestinian Authority, which doesn't control Gaza. They control the West Bank. So the big get here in this report is the concern that by requiring the Gazans to give a list to Israel of the projects that they're trying to rebuild, well, that becomes a list for targets for bombing raids and commando assaults. The next time Israel decides to invade Gaza or attack Gaza in what they crudely and cynically refer to as mowing the lawn. In Jakarta yesterday, there was an alleged terrorist attack on a Starbucks, on a police station. 7 people were killed, 23 people were injured. The Islamic State is claiming responsibility for this, but once again, we have to ask just how opportunistic this is. because there have been Muslim extremists called terrorists operating in Indonesia for a long time. It is the world's most populous Muslim nation. And so there are many characters, actors, and motives for this kind of an attack in Jakarta. And for the Islamic State to take credit for it, it sets off my bullshit detector. And this is the kind of thing that the U.S. media will portray unskeptically, at least not in the initial news reports. They'll just say, Islamic State, ISIL, 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 when the facts are certainly not proven or clear in terms of the real connection and whether this was an attack that was approved or ordered from Syria. I've talked quite a bit about the Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei. Ever since last spring, I went to Alcatraz and witnessed his powerful art exhibit. He's a brilliant guy, and he has suffered quite a bit, and he honored political prisoners incarcerated all around the world in a tableau, a tapestry, that were made from the plastic building blocks called Legos. And I was so impressed with this. You may have heard my conversation with John Kiriakou, who was the subject of this art exhibit while he was incarcerated, the CIA officer who didn't torture anybody but got sent to prison because he talked about torture. When I talked to John Kiriakou, when he got the postcards that Ai Weiwei had beautifully created and visitors to the Alcatraz exhibit mailed to the political prisoners, it was really touching and extremely powerful. So, you may know that recently Ai Weiwei has been trying to build an exhibit in Australia using similar technique, using Legos. And the Danish-based company that makes Legos said they had a policy that, well, you know, we don't want this used for controversial political messages. And so they wouldn't sell him a bulk order of Legos when he placed it. So he went around them. They parked a BMW in Sydney, as I recall, and left the roof open, and people would just drop off their Legos. Well, Lego has relented and decided that in the future they're going to permit this because they don't want misunderstandings or to be perceived as inconsistent. Ai Weiwei, you won this one. Congratulations. Al Jazeera America has announced it'll be signing off its cable news operation. And while I only have watched it occasionally, I value their entry into the U.S. market. I don't believe everything Al Jazeera reports, particularly when it comes to issues that are close to its owners in the Emirates in Qatar. There are many outstanding Americans who went to work for Al Jazeera America, including Trevor Aronson, Ray Suarez from PBS. And this was the channel that was purchased from Al Gore. It used to be called Current TV, if you remember that, back in 2013. But Al Jazeera America is not cutting it financially, and I guess the emir has decided to save his money, and they will be shutting down at the end of April. And finally today, I want to pay tribute to my old friend Al Hart. Al was the morning news anchor on KCBS Radio in San Francisco for over 30 years. And despite being a big, well-paid, superstar radio anchor, he was a regular guy. I worked down the hall from him for 7 years when I was at the CBS FM station in the 1980s, and that's how I got to know him. And then we served for years together on the local and national boards of our union, the American Federation of TV and Radio Artists, now merged with the Screen Actors Guild. And Al Hart was a real gentleman. He was a great newsman. He never tipped to me what his personal opinions were about anything, but he always asked me about mine and was curious and interested. And Al was a guy who had incredible presence on the radio. He was an old-school guy who never mispronounced a single syllable. And off mic, he was a curious man who liked a good drink of wine and a good meal, and we shared quite a few. Tragically, he retired when his first wife, Sally, they were married for over 40 years, developed ALS. and he took care of her until her death. Then he remarried to a great woman named Pat, and shortly after that, he was diagnosed with a different condition called corticobasal degeneration. And I haven't talked to Al in 4 or 5 years because he was not lucid, but I have the greatest regard for him personally and the work that he did, the standards that he set for news gathering and reporting here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Al Hart, happy trails, my friend.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.